So we have a big Bevo festival next week, and Kellen offered to give us a primer if he has money. But I heard to ask all of your questions, please.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So yeah, I want to thank ITP for hosting me. So I want to make myself useful. So ask me your questions, concerns. You might have read in papers, you know, proposals about BMO experiment. And just interrupt me anytime you have questions. I'm sure you have some. So I'm going to start with detectors. For microwave background polarization measurements. Now, there used to be a wide range of technology in interferometry, even for detectors, even for imaging instruments, there were correlation polarimeters versus direct detectors. But now, you know, all these seems to be condensing to the superconducting base transition edge sensors. So these are just very sensitive thermal detectors operating at the transition of a piece of superconductor from normal to superconducting transition. So the nice thing about these is you can lithographically define a large array of these, okay, instead of, you know, hand assemble, you know, semiconductors together to make sensitive thermal detectors. That was the old way of doing things, like Planck. Now you can just lithograph thousands of detectors on a single wafer. So that's the main advantage. Additional advantage is you can, because these are superconducting edge transition edge sensors, you can use squid multiplexers to read the tiny current off them. And squid sensors essentially has no readout noise, very little readout noise. So it can imagine spending very little time on a detector, moving to the next one, spend very little time on it, go to the next detector, and go back, you know, after you read, you know, now I guess 32 detectors, without, you know, the first detector changing its value. Okay, so you're spending less integration time on your sensor, but since there's no readout noise in the current sensor, you're not impacting the overall sensitivity. Okay, so this is a technique called multiplexing. So these are the main advantages for superconducting base sensors. So these detectors operate at sub-Kelvin temperatures, typically less than 300 millikelvin or 0.3 Kelvin. So cryogenics present a big issue. And also, because these detectors have reached background limit, so given a background, so this is a ground-based experiment, you have such and such photon noise, okay? And you can make your detectors sensitive enough such that the intrinsic noise in the detectors won't matter. It's just the photon noise under that background. Going to space, same way. You just make your detectors even slightly more sensitive, and it's dominated by the much lower background in a space environment. Now we can do that routinely. That also means the only way for your experiment to be more sensitive is to build lots and lots of detectors, meaning large focal planes operating under Kelvin. So that presents a large cryogenic challenge because of the, in particular, space as well, but in particular for ground-based experiment, we're talking about focal planes this size with windows this size. So that's hundreds of watts of ambient loading onto your instrument, yet, you know, you have to cool your detectors to less than a Kelvin. So you have to reject a large fraction of the infrared loading to begin with. Okay, so that's a challenge.
What's the lowest frequency?
Sorry?
Frequency that you can get?
With background limited sensitivity with direct detectors, I think that's what you mean. So far, there's not a lot of motivation to go below 90 gigahertz. But yet, you know, really there's nothing wrong with a low frequency detector built or designed using the same principle. So it'll be really hard to build Planck-type bolometers at low frequency because it's a gigantic spider web, you know, and it has you know resonances at low you know frequencies, etc., and has large heat capacity. But now bolometers are primarily antenna coupled, meaning there's an active antenna, and you don't require the mechanical or thermal property of that antenna to scale with wavelength. So that part scales with wavelength, but the active part, active detector part, doesn't scale with the wavelength. So with that technology, it's really nearly impossible for that to matter. So I think it's really a straightforward extrapolation down to low frequency. In fact, it should be easier. It's just nobody, people are too busy, you know, observing at, you know, these sweet windows as of yet. But if we see something at these windows, there will be motivation for sure to observe at as wide range of frequency as possible. So just to give you a sense of the type of sensitivity we're talking about. So like I said, you can make detectors background limited on the ground, on a balloon, in space. So in space, we've been talking about, so Planck sensitivity is about 50, tens of microkelvin root second, meaning staring at a point for 1 second, you reach the noise level of tens of microkelvin. On the ground, it's a few hundred, okay? So from, for example, 40 to 400, that's a factor of 100 in integration time. So it makes a big difference going to space, okay? So a ground-based 10,000 pixel detectors works as well as, you know, a space-borne 1,000 pixel detectors. So that's just a big integration sensitivity gain from going to space. On a balloon, in principle, you can reach similar sensitivity. In practice, you rarely do so. But the killer is the integration time available on a balloon, especially with liquid cryogen. Typically, it gives you about 10 days. That's all. 10 days of integration with, I don't know, factor of, I want to say 10 to 20 survey speed advantage on the balloon compared to the ground. So the more integration time on the ground and, you know, more sensitive detectors on a balloon in principle cancel, roughly cancel. So any detectors, in particular these thermal detectors, have 1 over F noise, meaning it's really hard to, for example, CMB, the 4 Kelvin, sorry, 3 Kelvin CMB temperature. See, it's very hard. It was very hard to measure, even in the beginning, because it was an absolute measurement. You have to compare what you measured with the 4 Kelvin helium load and take the difference rapidly in order to actually see a signal. You can't just stare at the sky for 5 minutes, look at something else, go back, and you see entirely different numbers. So these are 1 over F noise, you heard of it. So in any CMB instruments, we modulate, okay? Also, for colorimetry, sometimes we modulate, but we shouldn't confuse the two. So in polarimetry, we modulate because we want to get rid of instrument effect, okay? So I'll get to that in a bit later, and I'll give you an example. But primarily, you modulate because you want to move away from 1 over F noise. You want to compare two temperatures rapidly instead of...
What do you mean by modulating?
For example, in principle, you can use, so we had this lunch discussion a few days ago, right? You could use FIRAS to detect CMB anisotropy. Nobody did, right? Because it was a, you know, spectroscopy experiment measuring temperature in one direction of the sky very precisely. Okay, in principle, you can take the difference of that temperature and get anisotropy out of it. But you make this measurement very much later then you make this measurement. So the calibration, the level of the instrument is completely different. So if you just do naive difference, you get something that's just nonsensical. In other words, if you just plot the power spectrum of your time series, okay, there is a 1 over f rise. Okay. So this is your photon background noise, but then there is a 1 over f noise, depending on how good of an experimentalist you are. This is usually around half a hertz or hertz or something. But you can't do measurements at minutes time scale. Nobody can.
Okay. When you say modulating, it means that I compare with the
frequency yes. faster than me. Yes. So once you take, this is the spectrum of your experiment, right? So you want to put a spatial scale on it. So usually you just scan. And the scan speed determines whether this is L of 100 or L of 10 or L of 1,000, okay? So you convert a temporal spectrum to a spatial, you know, or angular power spectrum by changing your scan speed. So this is important because this is not the only feature in a typical CMB experiment, power spectrum of a CMB experiment. You have all sorts of things, you know, interference, and then all of a sudden your detector loses sensitivity because of the beam. Okay, so I'm talking about a deconvolved. Okay. Loses sensitivity to even the arrival of photons. Okay, so you see this drop because photons arrive, but that couldn't introduce any noise even. Okay, so this is kind of a typical PSD of an experiment, and you want to fit your science by tuning your scan speed. Say you want to study L of 100 or 50 to 1,000. You try to squeeze your science into that temporal PSD. So therefore, and you have a finite bandwidth, really. It's a little hard. It's much harder to try to do, for example, beam mode and lensing simultaneously because we're talking about covering from L of 20 to 4,000. And you need all of that to be clean bandwidth. And all sorts of things can cause non-ideality in the noise spectrum. Okay.
So can you repeat, what is your problem on the right and on the left?
So for any experiment, first of all, you have a 60 hertz. Well, depending on where you are in Europe, it's going to be 50. beyond that, yeah, beyond that, there's floor vibration, there's a truck going by, you know, and if your experiment is sensitive to that vibration, you're going to pick up things. So now we're moving away from, for ground-based experiments, we're moving away from liquid helium cooled. So detectors are cooled to sub-Kelvin, but you still could cool most of your instrument by either liquid helium or a mechanical cooler to 4 Kelvin as an intermediate temperature stage. We're moving away from using liquid helium, but that also means the mechanical oscillation from your mechanical cooler can introduce lines. Yeah. I should, you know, give you an example of a typical PSD, but you can find these.
Plank, for example, has a spectrum of 4K cooler lines.
Right, 4K. So for ground-based experiments, we typically use a so-called pulse tube cooler, which oscillates at about a hertz. So at a hertz, potentially, and all of its harmonics, you potentially can have contaminations. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
And what is a typical scale for one over noise?
It's usually thermal. It's usually thermal of one kind or another. Thermal drifts in your optical elements, thermal drifts in your detector plate, mm-hmm. Et cetera.
Okay, and what is the time scale?
So like I said, if you don't pay close attention to the thermal fluctuation on your focal plane, you typically get 1 over f noise of about a hertz. if you control the temperature, it's a, you know, 0.1 hertz or something. Anything below that is very hard.
So the window is not very well defined because there is a.
So this.
Those mechanical things are 1 hertz also.
So. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Right. So this is not optical. So far, none of these will be optical, right? Of the background. What do you mean? Right. So in principle, some of these are so-called common modes. Okay, so, okay. I think, you know, well, there's a lot of interest in even this. Okay, that's good. But the typical way of measuring polarization nowadays with direct detectors is basically to measure the amount of power for one antenna versus the amount of power in another antenna co-locating. And just take the difference, and that's your, you know, Stokes Q, okay? And do the same thing for something rotated at 45 degrees, that's Stokes U parameter, okay? So when you take the difference, some of these obviously go away. For common mode signals, some of these go away, but not all, okay? And sometimes we just call pair diff PSD, meaning you take the difference first, then you make this, you know, PSD, and it still shows up, you know, these features, and you can't get away from that. That's already pair-diffed, and that's your presumably a Q PSD, something like that, and you have to fit your size in there. So I've already mentioned this co-locating property being important, right? So imagine your beam or angular response of your A detector is slightly different on the sky from your B detector, okay? And when you take the difference, you see a difference. Although you're actually measuring the temperature gradient of the two detectors, okay? You're not measuring the real polarization if you don't have co-locating detectors. You're basically converting a T-map, for example, measured by W Planck. You know, these are huge fluctuations now, it seems. The gradient of that T-map into a fake polarization, okay? So basically, the gradient of T, okay, is a potentially contaminated mode, okay, that in the end we regress out. So hopefully John Kovac can talk more about this either later today or next week, early next week. But it's a process we call deprojection. But this is the cause of it, for example. Okay.
We use a known temperature map to do it.
Yes, we use a known temperature map to do it. So it's a linear algebra. So you basically just remove any contribution of that template to the polarization map. You're removing anything in your polarization map that looks like the gradient of temperature, for example. So you're losing some information, but you're retaining more. All right. So far, so we've been doing this for a while. So far, we've been using scanning as our main modulation mode to just get away from one-width noise. And we've been using other techniques to remove potential systematic effect from the beams. Okay, like this deprojection. Some people choose to modulate, okay, the polarization angle intrinsically in the instrument, okay, by having a so-called halfway plate that rotates the orientation of linear polarization coming into the receiver, okay? But that shouldn't be confused with the primary modulation, which is often the scanning, okay? In other words, the rate of that modulation, in principle, doesn't have to be that fast as long as you can control your systematic stable enough. Of course, if your grid, if your pixels are doing this on a time scale that's a few seconds, you have to spin your halfway plate faster than that, but usually that's not what's happening. So usually you only take it out sequentially, not in real time, okay? You just make the same measurements in a few steps, and you take it out later. You don't have to do it fast. So one is modulation, one is just basically a cancellation of systematic effect. Okay, so you don't, in principle, need to spin your halfway plate too fast, only fast enough to as the stability of your instrument, basically. Questions? Okay. So all of these seem obvious, but there have been ongoing debate whether you need to modulate or you should modulate or etc. But the primary motivation is, first of all, you want to get away from 1/f, and then you want to cancel some beam effects. Yes?
And calculations.
I'm sorry?
When you are measuring your polarization, is the difference between the measurement of two detectors?
Right.
Really get to polarization, you need to calibrate your detector.
Exactly. Exactly.
Very high accuracy.
That's why, in addition to the gradient of the temperature, the temperature itself is something we want to deproject out. Okay. In fact, it's more complicated than that because you have different. So you make a map, and you cover this patch, you cover that patch. In fact, you can allow the temperature to go positive this way, negative that way. You still just still project out that mode. Anyway, so this is a complicated thing, and it'll take more time than I have. Yes, yes, that really means moving around. Oh, so for example, in bicep kick, we've been doing about 2 degrees per second, okay? And the reason is just to put 0.1 hertz, the lowest frequency we still think we can have reliable measurement on at roughly, I can't remember, 30, LF 30 or something. So that anything above L, 0.1 hertz would be, you know, in our sensitivity band. So, because we're really targeting the degree scale BMO stuff.
And you do that, how much of the sky do you...
Yes. So, you know, this is a Fourier transform, right? So, if you want your lowest L band to be L of 30, you have to cover what is that number? A few degrees at the very least. But in fact, you're already throwing away some modes that were, you're often throwing away a few bends lower than the first science bend. So you want to cover more of that, more than the minimum required to cover it. So in bicep, we cover roughly 30 degree by 30 degree. It's just to get to L of 50. Okay. Hey. So, so John can probably talk more about scanning and cross-linking later and deprojection. I only touched like very briefly on these things. I was trying to explain 1/f noise and, you know, trying to squeeze. But just the tensor signal, if you recall, peaks at L of roughly 100. Okay, so this is L, this is E sub L square, roughly. This is roughly L of 100. But then there's also this lensing signal that peaks at L of roughly 1,000. Okay, so the amplitude of this is quite well known by now. It's not directly detected. So this is B mode. Okay, it's not directly detected yet, although it will be detected soon. But the amplitude, if you use parameter estimation, is now known to better than 3% already, okay, if you just infer the amplitude. Okay. In other words, we're trying to detect something above that relatively well-known signal, okay, on degree scale. So I think if you match the R value at L of 100 for lensing to an equivalent tensor, it's R of 0.02 or something. So that's R of 0.02.
Is that something you learned relatively recently, or was it all?
No, it's been known for a long time, yeah. For.
In other words, this is not the foreground that you worry about or whatever?
Oh, this is one foreground. So this is the foreground that has the same color as the BMO CMB. Okay, so this is the foreground you can't remove by observing at many, many frequencies. Okay, so the foreground you could remove by observing at many, many frequencies is the galactic emission, dust emission, polarized foreground. Okay, because it has different photon emission spectrum than a black body. But this one is black body as well. Depending on how much sky you cover, I have some plots later. Okay. So to study this signal, at the minimum, you want to have a resolution of about 1 degree, okay, or slightly big, about 1 degree, okay, and you want to cover at the very least 10 degree by 10 degree, and quite possibly more if you're worried about losing the first few bands due to contamination, okay. So I talked about main beam effects, systematics due to mismatching main beams, and also gain. Okay, we discussed gain. But there's also far silobes, which could be a big worry. So what's a silobe? A silobe is your detector through all the optics has non-zero sensitivity to something other than your well-defined Gaussian beam. For example, if you have a point source right here, you have some finite sensitivity to it due to silobe coupling. In other words, you just, how do you measure silobe? You just take a bright source and just scan back and forth, you know, across the whole sky to see if it has any sensitivity to anything other than your main beam. It's called the far silobe, okay? So that's obviously a big issue if you have a diffuse silobe. That's very hard to measure because as you're scanning, this thing will pick up large-scale CMB temperature. Or the galaxy, sometimes the ground, if it's a ground basically, or sometimes the moon, converting that to a spurious polarized signal. Also, the main beam might have a hard to measure shelf or pedestal or halo, and that's going to take, you know, large scale CMB stuff. And if it has a polarized response, it'll become a polarized signal as well. So in addition to these main beam issues, there are these silobe issues. So you really need to measure your experiments, characterize your experiments really well. So John, do you want to talk about compact experiments versus large telescopes?
Yes.
Following this lead.
Yeah, you're doing great. I'm not sure what exactly I missed. Sorry. But
I talked about detectors.
Okay, so
TES, squid readout.
And you talked about the fact that primarily you have detectors that are sensitive to T plus Q or T minus U. So temperature plus polarization, every detector is sensitive to both. And generally, we measure polarization by taking the differences of the detector.
Yes, that's
the differences of the beam that
right.
The open temperature drops out of, but of course, only drops out perfectly at one point to match the gain. So I guess it might be helpful to put some numbers to the challenges of temperature polarization leakage. Okay, so I can. I can say R of 0.01 B modes is at the peak, around L of 80, corresponding to an RMS signal on the sky of around 30 nanokelvin. So the temperature signal that's unavoidable in the cleanest field on the sky, right where you want to measure the beam modes, is of course the primary temperature anisotropies. So CMBT is going to be 30 microkelvin. Okay, so an RMS that's three orders of magnitude larger. So hopefully further outside the fields that you're using to constrain beam modes, you have the galaxy coming in. So galaxy, and now I'm going to, all of these numbers are going to be typical variations on the scales of a few degrees on the sky, at which we're primarily constraining that beam mode peak, the primary peak for inflationary gravity waves. So on scales of 2 to 4 degrees, L of 50 to 100-ish, we're talking about a galaxy at 150 gigahertz might be in the range of 0.3 to 30 millikelvin, say. Okay, so we've jumped up by another 1 to 3 orders of magnitude. And then for ground-based experiments, you've got the atmosphere. And there we've got both fluctuations, and we've got the fixed gradient in the atmosphere that we observe against. And ground-based experiments typically scan at constant elevation, so we scan across that gradient, not primarily sensitive to it. But there we're talking about signals that may range from, on these scales, 30 millikelvin to, if we're talking about across the gradient, we're talking 3 Kelvin. And now, if we talk about the ground and other bright sources, we're talking on these scales, things can vary from 3 Kelvin to, in the worst case, if you're talking about scanning on and off a horizon on degree scales, you could have up to 300, 200 Kelvin, say. But okay.
You're still talking about differences, right? All these
differences. Yes, these are all differential measurements, but this is a worst case scenario, right? Yeah. I mean, more typical would be 3 to 30 Kelvin. It is the kind of contrast you see in the ground on these scales of several degrees. Okay, so we're talking a huge dynamic range of suppression that you need to control the main beam effects in the case of pickup from the primary temperature and the side lobes for these. And so we use a variety of techniques to achieve that that huge degree of suppression here that we've got. I should add it up. We're talking about Kelvin to nanokelvin here, 10 orders of magnitude. So for the things that are that don't rotate with the sky, you get a huge factor from filtering your experiment so that the things that aren't moving with your field average down. And so we do scan-wise subtraction. Our experiment scans back and forth across the ground, and you do some kind of differencing scheme. Where you subtract off a fixed ground signal that hasn't moved with the sky. And so you're left with only the time variable part of the ground signal or the atmosphere if you do that scheme. But those kinds of differencing schemes, of course, don't help you with the galaxy where the field is rotating with your sky. And so one technique that is particularly useful for experiments that are able to achieve it is rotating your instrument on your primary field so that the way that the side lobes intercept the galaxy changes. And you're able to modulate that for consistency checks or average down the pickup that you get where your A beam and your B beam that you're differencing for your polarization have slightly different side lobe pickup to the galaxy. So,
So, sorry, just so I understand that comment, you're using the side lobes as a useful thing? I mean, you're actually...
No, the side lobes are a nuisance, but you're using the ability to rotate your instrument as a way of managing them.
So you have side lobe here.
I thought you were saying you were using something about how they look at the galaxy to map the galaxy.
You're suppressing the pickup that you would get from the interaction of a side lobe. If you're scanning your CMB field, your clean field, it has no galactic emission in it. But the galaxy is off over here, 40 degrees away. As your side lobe intercepts the galaxy, you have a fixed systematic signal that's contaminating the map that you're trying to make of that region. But then as you rotate your instrument, you have a different side lobe pickup on the galaxy, and so you form a different map of the same region that has a different systematic contamination.
Because our is almost in the side lobe, because
So I'll say that just in terms of side lobe control, there's an intrinsic difference between experiments that have apertures that are small enough that they're able to fully enshroud the experiment in some kind of baffle that can actually intercept and cut off the side lobes beyond a certain angle. So there are a number of small aperture experiments in this class, but I think the experiments that we run, BICEP and the Keck array, are primary examples of this. There are some others that have small enough apertures where you've given up the resolution of a large aperture and the ability to measure all of this information, but you allow yourself to have a compact instrument and cut off those side lobes hard so that at large angles, where these very bright signals are already, you've got your absolute best suppression control of side lobes. So larger aperture telescopes, like the 10-meter self-pole telescope, or the 7-meter AXE telescope, 7-meter, are large enough that they have some degree of shielding around their apertures, but it's not practical to make a four baffle that's large enough that it completely enshrouds and puts your telescope in a bucket, essentially, that will completely intercept those side lobes. So the other advantage you can get with a smaller size telescope is it's easier to achieve that boresight rotation. So some of the larger telescopes, all of the largest, don't actually have the ability to get that boresight rotation. But those that are at sites other than the South Pole get some degree of rotation naturally from the parallactic rotations the sky moves across, because they tend to be Alfaz mounts. So you get some degree of modulation that way. So is that what we had in mind for talking about trade-offs and systematic?
Right. So, you know, we're trying to give a disinterested talk. So it's worth pointing out for these large telescopes, they almost don't have to worry about main beam systematics, at least in the context of BMO direct detection, because the interesting scale is a few degrees and their beam is arc minutes. So it's okay if there's a big relative displacement between the two.
So the main beam systematics, if you expand our beam in a basis where we're talking about in terms of the spatial derivatives of the beam, the first order and second order displacements of the main beam shape itself. So the differential, the pointing offset of the two detectors, you might be effectively differencing the form of polarization measurement, but the differences in beam width or ellipticity of those detectors. Those all happen at small enough angular scales that those effects wind up here on that plot. But it's still true that such telescopes have side lobes.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean that you don't have to worry about leakage from the temperature signal into the polarization signal, because this is a factor of 1,000, and so you need to be able to account for 99.9% of your beam power if you want to assure yourself that you don't have to worry about temperature polarization leakage from the primary CMB temperature anisotropies. And that's very challenging. That means you've got to measure well beyond the main beam, out into the airy rings. The features in your side lobe need to be understood very well, and what degree the two polarized detectors are matched matters quite a lot. So to measure that effectively, as Trellin says, ideally you want a bright source. It's convenient if such a source is one that you can control and turn on and off, that you can modulate. So that allows you to achieve very high precision measurements. If you don't have the luxury of being able to produce an artificial source, a beacon that you can turn on and off, so you can measure those things directly in the field, then people tend to use planets. Or if you've got a high resolution experiment, you can use extragalactic sources, contact point light sources. But you know, ultimately, the thing, I think the number to keep in mind is you've got, if you want to be in the clear on primary CMB temperature to polarization leakage, an experiment has to account for 99.9% of their beam power.
So in other words, if you next time you see a SPT or AC beam, it looks beautiful, but then you really ought to put this on a log plot and see how it
works. Yes. You can't tell from
a right. So you put it on a log plot and you ask whether, you know, this is well behaved all the way down to 40, 50 dB level, the necessary level. And that's usually out to a few degrees from the main beam already.
Are you now talking about the same thing you were discussing before with the gradients of the temperature, or is it something else?
Related, right? So this gives you a gradient. If you use this experiment to observe the CMB temperature, you see a gradient, and you thought that's a polarization signal. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, for SPT or ACT, these high-resolution experiments, those effects show up at high L. At the angular scale of the beam, not at the angular scale of the interest, you know, of interest. Where is my clipboard?
Is it possible?
You're worried about sign bounds, the bounds being at least things are asymmetric in the sign. So you need to have a template to, you know, calculate.
Are you talking about this leakage?
Yes.
This? Yeah, so the template is a gradient of CMB temperature.
But you need to know how that responds to your samples.
Do you want to answer that, John?
The so you want to develop a model of your beam one way or another, and you can separate the problem out. You know, we do in our analysis between the expansion of the main beam and the first and second order effects. So the things that are easy to assign particular names to, like the pointing offsets and the difference in the beam width and the difference in the ellipticity of the average fixed beams. And you can treat those effects especially, right? You can easily model
the temperature polarization. What do you mean for side lobes?
They are, they're different for every experiment. For the bicep telescope, they look quite symmetric, and they look like a series of area rings because we have a symmetric optical system and we've got a truncated aperture. But there's some degree of polarization to them that needs to be understood, and you need to simulate that as well. So, you know, we choose to do that as a separate simulation. So we separate out the problem, but, you know, different experiments, different approaches to that. It's not uncommon, but I think, you know, I've seen the far side of simulations, which I think are separate from the main beam simulations, yeah. So temperature polarization leakage, you can sort of divide up and conquer the problem by modeling different parts of it. One of the reasons why we're motivated to model the main beam separately from far side lobes is that we have an exact procedure to remove the main beam leakage, and side lobes may be small enough that they can be, the resistance can be tolerated at a given level. But, you know, that's an experiment dependent statement.
When you plan, who would you believe the cross calculations, the
limited in accuracy, right? Because we have, you know, they're wavelength dependent, and you have to convolve it with a bandpass to actually get the effective side length for each detector. So it's very expensive. I mean, most of the modeling is monochromatic.
Yes. And one of the questions is how it changes.
That's right.
Considering the bands,
we make a constellation.
Yeah. It's a very significant issue for Planck. You get that model right, and data is always good to bring to the problem. If you've got it, so you use a model to extrapolate beyond where your data takes you inside the models.
So are you saying you can hope to do more just measurement with Planck
as a model?
Like Kellen said, we're trying to avoid giving a partisan talk, but it's true that experiment on the ground has not created artificial sources in front of your telescope in the field.
So you are saying?
Well, yeah, that's one very nice thing to be able to do.
I'm just as a novice, I'm trying to understand.
An advantage of doing that is you can modulate that source, and you can pick out very faint, far side lobe response on top of a large background.
So the physical world is a very powerful computer, and it models itself very well.
Yeah, in principle, if you know all of this perfectly, you can just remove all of that. We're trying to approximate that.
Or, you know, as a first step, you can simulate it perfectly and then judge whether or not it's necessary.
Obviously, in the lab, these cannot be measured that many. You cannot measure them. I mean,
so you have to put the source in the far field of your experiment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
which is a few hundred meters for us and a few tens of kilometers for larger telescopes.
For example, LHC is a big tunnel. I mean, no, can you? No, it exists some facility. Like a few hundred meters, you said, right?
We don't need it to be vacuum, so.
No. Okay, this is not that. No,
you get done in one atmosphere.
The far field scale is d squared over lambda, and so that's another advantage of having a small aperture is that you're effectively at infinity if you're a few hundred meters away, and it's easy to achieve that. That's the flip side of saying you've got a big fat beam.
A few hundred meters, I would say that maybe it's possible to do an artificial measurement.
Oh, yeah. We do it. We do it at the South Pole. We do it.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Right, but it's much harder for larger telescopes to do this.
So it's not only modeling. You know what is your beam or side lobes.
That's right. We have an opportunity as we get to get access to our telescope every year to go back and remeasure this thing, remeasure it ad nauseum. So
that's the problem with the satellite, you couldn't do it before you showed up.
Well, I'm sure efforts were made to
do
an arrangement.
We have these problems, and then we have this problem on the expression time that we have on the clocks. We get your bias pretty big. The main effect of the cycles is missing complexities, so then, overall calibration.
Characterize at what level that is compared to the I just threw out this level of
point 4% in PAM.
Yeah.
So something like that.
It's a really challenging problem. I mean, I a challenge of doing it in the lab before launch for a satellite mission is you know, replicating everything about the flight environment. I'm certainly not the expert on this, but I've been amazed to read the fraction of the long papers that I've read, and you know, things like the thermal stresses on the mirror and the honeycomb backing structure actually produce significant gradient loads that show up in the side load model. So it's really challenging.
So that's what you're trying to model. Things like that. Among other
things. So we're using models to estimate, you know, missing some data.
So it has to do with the geometry of the instrument, basically, that is complicated. I mean, is that, you must put something into your model that you measure.
Diffraction, scattering, all of that.
Yeah, I'm just asking at the totally elementary level.
So the shape, so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a complex model of the telescope that it supports. And
I mean, while you have it on the ground, you can tell what shape. Or you're saying when you launch it, those things change enough that you have to.
You have to do that. Very low sensitivity.
Yeah, okay.
So, you rely on the physical optics model.
But the input to that is the things
that.
Is
the
geometry.
It's the geometry that you know very well.
And that we measure on the scale. Yeah, to some extent.
Okay. Oh, for example, on this log plot. For example, on this log plot, perhaps you can measure this well down to this level, which matches up well with your, you know, expectation, and then you can perhaps trust what the model predicts at the lower level.
And the model is about how light propagates.
Yeah, yeah. For example, if you have a
and how the geometry varies with temperature.
Yeah.
Model.
You have diffraction, etc.
Check the geometry on the sky in the flight.
So you have data, right? So you do some consistent. You have certain data implied. And when you say expensive, does that mean sort of? You wish you had more computers than exist in the world, or just try to.
Well, I know from the WMAP team that they spend more computing cycles on modeling the cycles than they did on any other particle analysis. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what it is for playing.
Why one came here and get one of the pictures from the mirror, which was screwed up in the costume of the direction?
We should also add that we try to cross-check the model of the far side lobe on the sky. The highest frequency, the far side lobe pick up the galaxy, and we see that on the data, so we can use at least at this frequency the amount of signal that we have in the far side lobe to estimate the missing and matches with what we had on the calculation. It's hard to do the same thing at the CMB frequency because the galaxy is much fainter and it's not seen anymore.
Have you guys seen Deimos in foreground?
If you look at the galaxy, you see it right away. If you point your telescope to in the direction of the galaxy, there it is. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about this lensing signal. So like I said, you know, you want to survey tens, 10 degree by 10 degree or a little more to look at this signal. But the question remains whether you want to survey the whole sky or 10 degree by 10 degree or 50 degree by 50 degree. So one corresponds to larger sky coverage, but shallower maps, basically. So this is the classic CMB pursuer's question, how much sky to cover. In the case of B mode, there's this vending signal coming in beyond, 10 arc minutes or something. There's foreground, which usually follows the red spectrum. Okay, so you're kind of sandwiched in between. But then there's also hopes of removing the lensing signal by using a procedure called known as delensing. So basically, this lensing signal was produced by lensing of E mode, primordial E mode, by large scale structure in between. Okay? In principle, if you can reconstruct the large scale structure, you can predict what kind of B mode it'll generate, and you can subtract that. So this is a procedure called delensing. So basically, you observe Q and U maps, and you use those to produce E and B maps, okay? And you use the measured E and B maps to reconstruct the lens in front of the CMB, okay? The integrated projected matter distribution. Okay, if you count the number of degrees of freedom, it works out, because if you don't have primordial B, you have 2n pixels in here, 2n degrees of freedom, and you have one scalar, another scalar, so you also have 2n degrees of freedom. So in principle, you could reconstruct this completely in the absence of any noise. Okay, and then the next thing you do is you use this to calculate the gradient, for the deflection, and you take the observed E and you lens it with the reconstructed lens to calculate the B mode signal. Okay, so this is B mode entirely due to lensing based on the observation, and you simply delens by taking the difference of the observed B and the inferred lensing signal. And this is a way to, in principle, clean the lensing signal.
So people already talked about the lensing, planning about using polarization, right?
Yes.
Does that figure into this? This sounds like you do it all.
So in principle, so first of all, nobody has ever detected this yet.
No, I understand the part people haven't. So,
right.
But you can't use the...
So there's a much larger temperature signal out there. So that thing is lensed to produce non-Gaussianity.
That tells you something about this matter density.
Exactly, but that has a lot of sample variance noise. Whereas in here, in principle, if you have high signal through noise measurement of this B, and you believe the high L portion of it, okay, is entirely coming from lensing, then you can, in principle, derive phi only limited by the instrument noise, okay, in principle. And, in practice, all of the lensing signal happens at high L. And you can just apply a high-pass filter when you're trying to derive phi to avoid complicated interaction between what you're trying to measure and, So what you do is you apply a high-pass filter when you're trying to derive phi in here, so that this B lens has no information about low LB. And then when you take the difference, you don't have complicated correlation, bias, that sort of thing. And you can show in simulation that it works. Okay. So this procedure, in principle, works even if you are trying to delens at high L. Okay. So say your favorite model predicts a BMO signal at high L. In principle, you can still do it. So the trick is, in order to delens for this bin, you use information outside of that bin to do your lensing reconstruction. Okay? Then you do your subtraction. So you separate the delensing into bins. When you're calculating phi for bin L, you use all the information outside of L, outside of that bin. And then when you do that, you know, when you're trying to calculate phi for the next bin, you exclude all the information outside of, exclude all the information inside of that bin to calculate phi, et cetera. So with that procedure, you could delens at high L to reveal the primordial high L BMO signal if you have a theory that predicts that. Okay. But this is a well-established procedure, and the reach of that procedure is well known to quadratic order and beyond. Okay. So with some naive foreground model, you could estimate what reach in R can we get from a ground-based experiment, and that's, you know, what I've been doing in the past few days for a DOE review called Snowmass. So if I can show a few figures. Andre, for example, told me he has a theory that predicts R of 3.502 times 10 to the minus 3.
Production of sources of gravity waves anywhere during inflation. So that would give you an example of something that would be a blip, you know.
Yeah, so the parameters are the sensitivity of this. So this is a futuristic experiment, right? So the sensitivity of the experiment measured in microkelvin root second, just as a reference, Keck is now running at 9.5 or something microkelvin root second. It's been doing that for more than a year now. So this is something that's 10 times faster than Keck. And resolution of...
It's futuristic, it's just a factor of 3.
No, effect of 10 in survey speed. Effect of 3 in sensitivity, yeah. Okay. Yeah, but, you know, like I said earlier, you know, the detectors are more or less background limited, meaning effect of 3 in survey speed means effect of 10 bigger in focal plane size, the number of detectors, et cetera. So this is really an order of magnitude bigger.
Sigma is the expected error bar?
Yeah, so this is one sigma uncertainty for different experimental parameters. This is futuristic. This is even two orders of magnitude beyond what we have now.
The fixed duration.
So this is F sky, the direction of the sky you covered. So going in this direction, the maps becomes more shallow, not as deep. Yes, so fixed integration and fixed sensitivity. In fact, I threw in, you know, pi time 10^-7 seconds as a, you know, just a whole year of integration. That's roughly 3 years of real integration.
And you want to do better, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So this is... Right. So let me try to go through these. So for different resolution for with half max of the experiment, so this corresponds to roughly a 10-meter telescope. This is 1/8, you know, a meter telescope. Okay? 8 arc minutes. And I assume different foreground removal scenarios. Assuming you can clean the foreground down to 10% in the power spectrum, or, you know, square root of 10 in map space, or 5% in map space. So this is perhaps, you know, optimistic. This is probably pessimistic. So somewhere in between, perhaps, is what's going to happen. As you can see, this is all ground based. Okay, I'm not assuming 50 microkelvin per second, for example. I'm assuming reasonable numbers to come by. So this is, yeah, so if this seems, you know, not that futuristic, that's good, because this shouldn't be that futuristic. I've been reasonably realistic about this. Okay.
What do you consider the far future? I mean, what?
This is far future. This is really far future. This is more than 100,000 detectors.
Yeah,
if not quite a million.
The project we hear about now.
So the funded projects, none of the funded projects can reach this, I don't think. Yeah, I think that's a safe statement.
So the red line is reachable soon?
Depending on funding. Yes.
Within a factor of a few.
Yeah, within a factor of a few.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. So you'll go to 10 to the minus 3?
Before I did
or
this,
not.
Yes. I think when. So yeah, I know this will get people excited, but.
Today's Tuesday.
Right. So I just want to point out the trend. Okay. So large sky, you're measuring a large portion, you know, many B modes, and also many B modes in lensing. But you know the expectation value, so the way to distinguish lensing from primordial is to statistically measure the amplitude of the B mode in the power spectrum and subtract that just like we did with instrument noise. Okay, so that's what I call the debiasing procedure. So that's the dominant lensing removal scheme here. For small sky coverage, 10 degree by 10 degree or something, you're relying on that reconstruction to work to actually remove it in map space. But what I found was there's a fairly broad minimum, okay, for a wide range of experimental setup. And anywhere between, I want to say 50 degree by 50 degree to a few degree by a few degree, you have roughly approximately same reach in terms of one sigma error on R. One will rely on foreground removal on this side, and on this side you will have to rely on delensing. Okay.
Can I ask the foreground assumption that went in? Is it that across these range of F skies the foregrounds are equally bad, or are the foregrounds getting worse in the simulation for that?
So what happened was we took PSM and we found the best patch with corresponding F sky, and we calculate the B mode at L of 85. And we varied the F sky and find a fitting formula. And I just took the fitting formula to do this calculation.
So
it's not perfect, but yeah.
The fact that
right.
You grab more sky,
absolutely.
Foreground
right. So there's absolutely more foreground for these. But then you're measuring many more modes. Okay. So.
You've got a trade off.
Yes. There's also a trade-off between sensitivity and beam size, right? So for large beam experiments, you're not doing that well. So what are these? So these two, right? So you're not doing that well in terms of delensing because you're not measuring these modes, these high L modes that well. So you prefer to cover more sky to debias. For small beam experiments, it can do quite well with delensing. If you can't have both, then you know you have to ask, you know, which one you prefer, to have larger beam, more sensitivity, or vice versa. Okay, it depends on the cost profile of beam versus of telescope size versus detector numbers. But to me, I'm gonna guess, you know, these two experiments probably cost about the same in the middle. Yeah. So one is more.
Sorry, not the cost.
I don't know. I don't know. I
not even
20-30 million dollars scale. Yeah. Not LSC type.
No.
Yeah. So I don't know how interesting this plot is for this crowd. Leonardo knows this, but I'm not sure. So you can calculate phi to quadratic order or higher order, and this shows the effect of that. If you only go to quadratic order, you have these lines. But if you can really go to higher order, like the theorists, predicted. It's possible to do better. But this is the absolute limit, because there are still...
If you could, is this a technical issue? What sphere is this?
Okay, so this is so many steps removed from reality still, because nobody has detected BMO yet. So this is still...
So this is sort of saying, well, we don't really know how this is going to... Well, this is going to work, so there's a sort of theoretical...
So if you have...
Case,
yes.
But maybe we will...
Well, it's a little better than that. So if you have white noise, well understood noise, white noise in your simulation, and you go through iterative procedure, indeed it reproduces these curves. Okay, but you know, just...
So how well do you know your noise?
Yeah, so when you do the actual experiment, you'll know how poorly you perform, how well you perform. But I think it's safe to assume should be good enough for quadratic order. People are talking about using lensing as a precision cosmology tool.
I thought it's very, very low values. I have programs playing this program.
So
the dust, you know, the dust extends to high multiples. That's better. Dust extends to high multipliers, point sources are parallelized.
Right. So this calculation, of course, is highly simplified.
Yes.
So it just takes a power law, L to the minus 0.6 or something. So it does have high L mode. No,
it doesn't have a high L mode.
Yeah. Oh. It does, but it doesn't have point sources. So point sources have been assumed to be subdominant after, you know, they're identified and removed from the maps.
We're getting an idea of these contributions from 3.5.
Right. So, I really think, you know, 1 sigma R of 10 to the minus 3 is not completely crazy from the ground. It's 10 year horizon, yeah.
That would allow you to make an actual detection.
So this is 1 sigma.
No, this is 1 sigma, meaning you can detect something bit higher.
Yeah, so 0.01, you can have 10 sigma. I don't know. If let me. Okay. Yeah. Let me know if there's problem. Yeah. So this agrees with the two papers out there, one by Dick Bond and company, and another by Radek Stampor. So. Different foreground assumptions, you know, they assume 5% in power spectrum, but you know, I have a wide range to cover all of that. This doesn't rely excessively on completely optimal delensing. You know, I can just always go this way. I truly believe this is within reach.
Some time ago, there was like, 10 to the minus 4, forget it. And now you're discussing 10 to the minus 4, and nobody is...
So
why is such a dramatic change with the computation earlier?
So in CMB Task Force report was written in 2007. Right? 2005. Oh, thank you. 2005. And I think we're doing better than what's written in that report.
It's better than expected.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. So the goal stated in that CMB task force report was R of 0.02, right?
Yeah.
1 sigma, right?
Yeah, it was better, sigma. Like what
was... there was... Okay, so first of all, there was not a plot done in a similar way in that report. It was all kind of intuitive. I think it was, a lot of it was intuitive.
About the scaling of sensitivity.
Right.
Basically, our ability to scale up the number of detectors of experiments, we're pessimistic. And, it's easy to get Moore's law wrong because it's an exponential thing, right? So
and you didn't know it before, that it would be possible?
Do you really mean to say that 10 to the minus 4 is possible here?
I say 10 to the minus 3.
They can
10 to the minus 3.
Is recorded.
I take all of this with a real pinch of salt. Right?
What?
And can you
speak slowly?
We can build a million detectors.
So, this is in a few years.
I'm pretty confident in the assumption that we can build a million detectors. I think that just requires a commitment of $100 million. How the foregrounds are going to come in, the systematic challenges.
It's the systematic challenges that are the problem. So in reality, we start from the top, we learn how well we can control systematics, and you design the next experiment, and so on, progress down. Learning about how
and I think we're getting more confident, in this. I'm not crazily optimistic. I'm saying,
What is the
best upper limit on the rest? It's
0.7.
Yeah, it's
well,
very
it's
far.
So we're a long way.
I know, but...
And then you start to get excited about 10 to the minus 4. And
yeah, again, 10 to the minus 3 only, not the minus 4. But we are operating an instrument running at 9 microkelvin per second in MAP. That's MAP sensitivity, not instantaneous, measure in the lab. It's MAP sensitivity, 9. We've been operating that for 1.5 years. And that's not a very expensive, it's a fairly low cost experiment. And SPT3G on paper could reach this type of sensitivity in a few years. It's still vaporware. I assume very a pessimistic foreground scenario in here. So all in all, I do think 1 sigma 10 to the minus 3 is possible. I've already multiplied by 10. Do you want a comment?
What's your comment?
You're talking about what kind of reality checks are we going to get soon?
I'm just trying to troll for information about
anything.
Well, you'll hear more next week, but I think that I think maybe what we would say is similar to what we've been hearing from the pump people, that it's very challenging for those kinds of reasons to dig down into these data sets and really achieve the sensitivity limits. Our sensitivity has grown by leaps and bounds here. Mm-hmm. And so reaching those limits requires a lot of analysis work, but we remain optimistic. I don't think that we see fundamental roadblocks.
Yeah. So when you were saying a few times, when one that requires bicep, or?
Did I say a few times 0.01?
And when we were asking you about current projects, and where did it get on the spot?
Actually, bicep doesn't appear anywhere on here because we have a larger beam than any of these scenarios that Sheldon is giving out. So these are all, even the largest beam experiment on this with 8 arc minutes, still has sufficient resolution to start to do delensing, to start to take down the lensing signal.
Especially with this kind of sensitivity, So delensing works quite well, even for that resolution.
So bicep 2 and Keck is going to run up against this lensing signal. You should anticipate that we will see it as a source of confusion that we're not internally able to remove because of our large beams.
But these are if you reach 0.02 or more or less, right?
Sorry, all this is ground-based, so...
Yes, I assume ground-based type sensitivity.
Saying that you expect not to have anything on a balloon? Just an assumption or a
So like I said earlier, in principle, the balloon-borne experiment is much more sensitive. So in principle, if you have... Oh, so first of all, it's impossible to do this on a balloon, one arc minute resolution. This is plausible. It's been achieved. And in principle, well, I still think this is very hard for a balloon-borne experiment, if, unless you fly it 3 times or 10 times.
The way that I think about the trade-off is, if you were able to field exactly the same experiment with the same detector count,
right,
you might be able to get a factor of 10 increase in mapping speed.
That's what I talked about. Yeah.
Time.
Right.
The fact that you're not flying continuously through the year. But that scaling is you know, the fact that you can get 1/10 the time, the 10 times the mapping speed, I think has been one of the reasons why balloons historically have been very competitive with the ground. Whether it remains true that you can mount an experiment of similar complexity when the detector counts are now measured in the tens of thousands on a balloon, people are trying.
So for example, this I anticipated this to be a multi-platform experiment, not a single telescope. So to do it with the balloon, it means flying the same instrument multiple times. It's in principle possible.
And that there are, you know, getting large scales from a balloon is in principle something
right.
that might be an advantage.
But if you have the resources, what is the time scaling? Are we in the
I think we can start for making these experiments as soon as we have money.
Less than 10 years.
Yeah, I think so. I think, sure, we can, if we start building experiments now, they're not going to be perfect. But I think they might be sufficient.
I would say, for 3.5 microkelvin, 5 years, and for the 1.1, 15 years.
Yeah, I think this is more than 10 years. I think this is more than 10 years.
Can you repeat this number?
Yeah, but
15, 5. Mm-hmm. 5, 15. So, unless we discover a new theoretical limit on BMOS, right? So, is there?
No, just the limit.
Yeah. So we're relying on this incredibly clean BMO theorem to do this. Are there surprises? Are there theoretical surprises?
So just so I understand, you said if the sensor signal is high enough, it would be...
Right. Yes.
When you drew it, the primordial signal was bigger.
Yes.
Like you said, they agree that where you're looking at, if it were 0.01, but if it's higher than that, is it between 0.01 and 0.1, you know, you would, it would be bigger than the lensing.
Yeah, but this is all way smaller. These are all way smaller than...
No, I understand, but this is to go further than that.
Right.
I'm just trying to understand this thing you were just saying about the complication of subtracting it only comes out if you don't see it in that window. Just so I understand. It's easier to see if it's in the...
Sorry, I was removing. Okay.
What happens if you don't have a
screen? So I read a paper about string generated B-mode at L of 1,000. That's why I had that little discussion about delensing at high L.
In statistics, it would be different to the lensing statistics.
How would it show up?
Right, yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it's a Gaussian signal. or non-Gaussian? It's probably non-Gaussian.
Sure, it's
non-Gaussian.
Central.
Mm-hmm. That's a good problem to have.
It's true. If it's a non-Gaussian signal, your trick of only using BMODs outside the band that you're cleaning
doesn't work. Although it's hard to imagine that it'll E and B will couple in the same way lensing will couple, because that's a very specific coupling. And with enough modes, any different type of coupling could average down. I don't know exactly how cosmic strings work. I don't know.
Just put it through the whole pipeline.
But it works quite well. So that technique works quite well for Gaussian signal.
Very nice.
Great.
Thank you.